readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and like all of us, I ponder what motivates people. What inner workings drive our political and thought leaders? What has been influencing those common people who are making headlines? In literature, you'll agree that those writers who really let you glimpse into a character's soul are the authors you return to again and again. So this is our journey today. And along the way, we have a special guest, a psychoanalyst who puts, in theory, a very famous woman on her couch. I know I'm intrigued, so let's turn now to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
In Killing Lincoln, the shocking assassination that changed America forever, Bill O'Reilly, yes, it's him, and Martin Dugard delve into one of the most dramatic stories in American history, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Readers, I love reading about the Civil War. I've got degrees in history, and I thought I was pretty well informed. But this book uncovers a multitude of facts I never knew, and it delves deep inside the mindset of the main players, Lincoln, Robert E. Lee, U.S. Grant, and John Wilkes Booth. In the spring of 1865, America's Civil War finally comes to an end. President Lincoln's generous terms for Robert E. Lee's surrender are devised to fulfill Lincoln's dream of healing a divided nation and reintegrating the Confederates into American society. In the midst of patriotic celebrations in Washington, John Wilkes Booth, charismatic ladies' man and impenitent racist, murders Lincoln at Ford's Theater. Lafayette C. Baker, a smart but shifty New York detective and former Union spy, unravels the string of clues leading to Booth and his accomplices. The thrilling chase ends in a fiery shootout and a series of court-ordered executions, including that of the first woman ever executed by the U.S. government, Mary Surratt. Killing Lincoln is a history that reads like a thriller. However, in reading the reviews of this audio title and in listening myself, I found I shared the feelings of many listeners. Bill O'Reilly's narration makes this a hard listen. You feel his huge ego coming out on every page. It's sometimes hard to concentrate on the story, but it's a great story. See if you agree.
Any thought of serenity is a fantasy. The Confederate Army, under the command of General Robert E. Lee, has been pinned inside the city for more than 250 days by Union forces under the command of General Ulysses S. Grant. Though living in trenches and reduced to eating rats and raw bacon, Lee's men will not surrender. Instead, Lee is making plans to slip out of Petersburg and escape south to the Carolinas. If he succeeds, Lincoln's prayer for a reunified United States of America may never be answered. America will continue to be divided into a North and a South, a United States of America and a Confederate States of America. Lincoln's inaugural speech is a performance worthy of a great dramatic actor. And indeed, one of America's most famous thespians stands just a few feet away as Lincoln raises his right hand. John Wilkes Booth is galvanized by the president's words, though not in the way Lincoln intends. Booth, 26 years old, raised in Maryland, is an exceptional young man. Blessed with a rakish smile and a debonair gaze, he is handsome, brilliant, witty, charismatic, tender, and able to bed almost any woman he wants, and he has bedded quite a few. It's no wonder that the actor has known success on the Broadway stage. His fiancée stands at his side, a sensual young woman whose senator father has no idea that his daughter is secretly engaged to a man of Booth's lowly theatrical calling. Lucy Hale and John Wilkes Booth are a beautiful young couple, quite used to the adoration of high society and the opposite sex. Yet not even she knows that Booth is a Confederate sympathizer, one who nurses a pathological hatred for Lincoln and the North. Lucy has no idea that her lover has assembled a crack team of conspirators to help bring down the president. They have guns, financing, and a precise plan. At this point, patience is their watchword. Standing in the cold Washington drizzle in the shadow of the Capitol Dome, Booth feels nothing but hot rage and injustice. The actor is impulsive and prone to the melodramatic. Just before Lincoln's speech, as the president stepped out onto the East Portico, Booth's carefully crafted conspiracy was instantly forgotten. Though he had no gun or knife, Booth lunged at Lincoln. An officer from Washington's Metropolitan Police, a force known to be heavily infiltrated by Confederate sympathizers, grabbed Booth hard by the arm and pulled him back. The actor's struggles, which only made Officer John William Westfall grasp him tighter. Like everyone else in the city, Westfall is well aware that there are plots against Lincoln's life. Some say it's not a matter of if, but when the president will die. Yet rather than arrest Booth or even pull him aside for questioning, Westfall accepts Booth's excuse that he merely stumbled. Arresting a celebrity like Booth might have caused the policeman problems. But Booth is definitely not finished. He seethes as he listens to Lincoln's speech. The grace and poetry of the words ignite his rage. The sight of so many black faces beaming up at Lincoln makes him want to vomit. No, Booth is most definitely not finished. If anything, his determination to knock Lincoln off his throne becomes more intense. Lincoln isn't finished either. The president has epic plans for his second term in office. It will take every one of those 4 years and maybe even longer to heal the war-torn nation. Healing is Lincoln's one overriding ambition, and he will use every last bit of his trademark determination to see it realized. Nothing must stand in his way. But evil knows no boundaries, and it is a most powerful evil that is now bearing down on Abraham Lincoln.
That was Killing Lincoln by Bill O'Reilly. Malcolm Gladwell takes us on an intellectual journey through the world of the outliers, the best and the brightest, the most famous and the most successful. He asks the question, what makes high achievers different? His answer is that we pay too much attention to what successful people are like and too little attention to where they're from, their culture, their family, their generation, and the idiosyncratic experiences of their upbringing. Along the way, he explains the secrets of software billionaires, what it takes to be a great soccer player, why Asians are good at math, and what made the Beatles the greatest rock band. Brilliant and entertaining, Outliers, The Story of Success, simultaneously delights and illuminates. The author narrates.
In 1896, a dynamic young priest by the name of Father Pasquale Denisco took over at Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Denisco set up spiritual societies and organized festivals. He encouraged the town folk to clear the land and plant onions, beans, potatoes, melons, and fruit trees in the long backyards behind their houses. He gave out seeds and bulbs. The town came to life. The Rosettans began raising pigs in their backyards and growing grapes for homemade wine. Schools, a park, a convent, and a cemetery were built. Small shops and bakeries and restaurants and bars opened along Garibaldi Avenue. More than a dozen factories sprang up, making blouses for the garment trade. Neighboring Bangor was largely Welsh and English, and the next town over was overwhelmingly German, which meant, given the fractious relationships between the English and Germans and Italians in those years, that Rosetto stayed strictly for Rosettans. If you had wandered up and down the streets of Rosetto in Pennsylvania in the first few decades after 1900, you would have heard only Italian spoken. And not just any Italian, but the precise southern Foggian dialect spoken back in the Italian Rosetto. Rosetto, Pennsylvania was its own tiny self-sufficient world, all but unknown by the society around it, and may well have remained so, but for a man named Stuart Wolfe. Wolfe was a physician. He studied digestion in the stomach and taught in a medical school at the University of Oklahoma. He spent his summers on a farm in Pennsylvania, not far from Rosetto, although that, of course, didn't mean much, since Rosetto was so much in its own world, it was possible to live one town over and never know much about it. One of the times when we were up there for the summer, this would have been in the late 1950s, I was invited to give a talk at the local medical society, Wolfe said years later in an interview. After the talk was over, one of the local doctors invited me to have a beer. And while we were having a drink, he said, "You know, I've been practicing for 17 years. I get patients from all over, and I rarely find anyone from Rosetto under the age of 65 with heart disease." Wolfe was taken aback. This was the 1950s, years before the advent of cholesterol-lowering drugs and aggressive prevention of heart disease. Heart attacks were an epidemic in the United States. They were the leading cause of death in men under the age of 65. It was impossible to be a doctor, common sense said, and not see heart disease. Wolfe decided to investigate. He enlisted the support of some of his students and colleagues from Oklahoma. They gathered together the death certificates from residents of the town, going back as many years as they could. They analyzed physicians' records. They took medical histories and constructed family genealogies. "We got busy," Wolfe said. "We decided to do a preliminary study. We started in 1961. The mayor said, 'All my sisters are going to help you.' He had four sisters. He said, 'You can have the town council room.' I said, 'Where are you going to have council meetings?' He said, 'Well, we'll postpone them for a while. The ladies would bring us lunch. We had little booths where we would take blood, do EKGs. We were there for 4 weeks. Then I talked with the authorities. They gave us the school for the summer. We invited the entire population of Rosetto to be tested." The results were astonishing. In Rosetto, virtually no one under 55 had died of a heart attack or showed any signs of heart disease. For men over 65, the death rate from heart disease in Rosetto was roughly half that of the United States as a whole. The death rate from all causes in Rosetto, in fact, was 30 or 35% lower than it should have been. Wolfe brought in a friend of his, a sociologist from Oklahoma named John Brune, to help him. "I hired medical students and sociology grad students as interviewers, and in Rosetto we went house to house and talked to every person aged 21 and over," Brune remembers. This happened more than 50 years ago, but Brune still had a sense of amazement in his voice as he described what they found. There was no suicide, no alcoholism, no drug addiction, and very little crime. They didn't have anyone on welfare. Then we looked at peptic ulcers. They didn't have any of those either. These people were dying of old age. That's it." Wolfe's profession had a name for a place like Rosetto, a place that lay outside everyday experience, where the normal rules did not apply. Rosetto was an outlier.
That was Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. Dr. Alma Bond is a psychoanalyst who had a private practice in New York City for 37 years. She's published many books, but the one that we'll speak about today is Jackie O. It's the first of her On the Couch series. A very unusual premise, this is a story of Jackie's life from her own perspective, as imagined by Dr. Bond, who combines her professional insights with her longtime study of Jackie lore. The facts are all historically correct, and the result is a unique exploration of the life, the loves, and the thoughts of one of the most iconic figures of our time. Welcome, Dr. Bond. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. I'm eager to tell your listeners about Jackie O on the Couch.
Well, of course, as with any patient of yours, I suppose that you begin with the parents. And if you could talk a little bit about them and Jackie's relationship with them.
Well, her mother was a perfectionist and was highly critical. And if anything, this contributed to Jackie's really wonderful creativity, because everything she did was just about perfect. She very much favored her father Blackjack, who was not an admirable man in many ways, but he was, to her, a wonderful father. He really loved her, and he spent a great deal of time trying to find interesting things for her and her sister to do. And it was a love affair. She used to, after her parents' divorce, she used to sit and wait for her father all afternoon. And when he came up in his little red car, I think it was, she leaped out and into his arms. I think the only man she ever loved as much as her father was JFK.
What about Jackie's relationship with her sister Lee?
It was ambivalent. They grew up together, of course. Jackie was 4 years older, and Jackie was highly controlling and very much the boss. And in a way, Lee, the sister, remained Jackie's friend. When Jackie was in the White House, the Kennedy sisters were really rotten to her. And the only person she talked to about it was her sister Lee, just as Lee was the only person who understood what the two had gone through, what a painful time their parents' divorce was, and how Blackjack had treated them. So she needed her sister, and yet they were always terrible rivals. And I think that Lee probably never was able to adjust to the fact that she had such a wonderful big sister, and I doubt whether anybody could.
How did Jackie get through all the very visible sexual liaisons that the president had during his time in office?
She acted as if she didn't care, but she cared. She cared very deeply. It was probably one of the great hurts of her life. And one of the reasons she was able to form the attachment to Onassis was because he understood how hurt she was about Jack's womanizing, and talked with her about her, and sympathized with her, and gave back to her up that she had every right to be furious with him.
Well, since you brought up Ari, can you talk a little bit more about why she chose him? Many people believe it was just about the money, but you imply in the book that it was actually much more than that.
Absolutely. After Bobby died, Jackie was terrified. She said, if they're out to kill Kennedys, they're going to go after my kids next. And she said she just couldn't go through Bobby's death. She couldn't go through another assassination alone without a strong man on her side. And she said, who better than Aristotle Onassis, who had this magnificent yacht and an island of Scorpios way off across the ocean? And she felt that with him, she and her children would be safe. But that's only one reason. Another reason that I think people don't know about is that Jack was really, with all its womanizing, he was a terrible lover. He had no idea how to satisfy a woman. And Jackie went to a doctor who had to draw a diagram and show her where she should be feeling pleasure. She showed it to Jack, who laughed, and Jackie said he was just improving his technique when he was shot. Huh. But Aristotle Onassis was a magnificent lover, and he turned Jackie into a wonderful lover too. And in the early years of their marriage, he awakened her so that she had marvelous sex, and I think she always loved him for that.
Now, can you talk a little about Jackie's relationship with Bobby Kennedy after JFK was assassinated? They did have a physical relationship.
Yes. Well, she was, of course, terribly depressed when JFK died, and she stayed in bed most of the time. Her daughter Carolyn told her teacher, "My mother cries all the time. The only time she got up out of bed was to see Bobby. She felt that I think he looked like Jack. He talked like Jack. He smelled like Jack. In Bobby's arms for a few enchanted moments, it felt like she had Jack back again.
I see.
And then when he was killed, that almost sent her over the edge again a second time.
Now, there's an interesting quote in the book. You wrote that Jackie believed that she lived through men in her early years, but then eventually she changed that opinion. What brought about that change?
I think she grew up. I think that she became a professional editor for 20 years. She edited over 100 books, and she was actually the world's perfect editor. And the only job she ever really had besides First Lady was she was a camera girl on a newspaper when she was a young woman. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, as an editor, she became what she probably would have been had she not become First Lady of the land. She was meant to be an editor. She was a words person. She was a book person. She would walk down the street reading a book. Incidentally, I did write her about my first book, Who Killed Virginia Woolf, because I had seen her at a play about Virginia Woolf. And I said, I've written this book. I know you love Virginia Woolf. Would you like to edit it? And she wrote me back and she said, I loved your book, and I sent it to marketing, and unfortunately, they felt there isn't a wide enough audience for us.
Hmm.
And I'm so sorry, because that would have been a wonderful experience, and it would have put me on the map as an author long ago.
Surely. Well, what is your next project? Who else do you have selected to be on your couch?
The next book, which is in publication with Greenwood Press, is Michelle Obama, a biography. Mm. And that should be out in 2012, probably early in the year.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bond. I really enjoyed reading your book, and it certainly is a fascinating look at Jackie. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed every minute.
All right. Well,
bye.
Author Nasir Gaemi draws from the careers and personal plights of diverse leaders, including Lincoln, Churchill, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and JFK, to build an argument at once controversial and compelling. The very qualities that mark those with mood disorders, realism, empathy, resilience, and creativity, also make for the best leaders in times of crisis. A First-Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness, combines astute analysis of the historical evidence with new psychiatric research. For example, studies show that those suffering depression are much better than, quote, normal people, unquote, at assessing current threats and predicting future outcomes. Looking at Lincoln, Churchill, and others, Gaemi shows how depressive realism helped these men tackle challenges. The author's thesis is controversial and a provocative examination of the link between leadership, depression, and mania. Sean Runette narrates.
Most of us make a basic and reasonable assumption about sanity. We think it produces good results, and we believe insanity is a problem. This book argues that in at least one vitally important circumstance, insanity produces good results, and sanity is a problem. In times of crisis, we are better off being led by mentally ill leaders than by mentally normal ones. There are different kinds of leadership for different contexts. The non-crisis leader succeeds in ordinary times, but in times of crisis should be kept far away from the scepter of rule. As we'll see, the typical non-crisis leader is idealistic, a bit too optimistic about the world and himself. He is insensitive to suffering, having not suffered much himself. Often he comes from a privileged background and has not been tested by adversity. He thinks himself better than others and fails to see what he has in common with them. His past has served him well, and he seeks to preserve it. He doesn't acclimate well to novelty. We see the non-crisis leader all around us. The CEO, the department chief, your neighbor's boss, the bank president, the president. One more fact, he is quite mentally healthy. He has never suffered from depression or mania or psychosis. He has never seen a psychiatrist. Aristotle first speculated about the link between genius and madness 2,500 years ago. And at the height of the Romantic era, the 19th-century Italian psychiatrist Cesare Lombroso defined that link forcefully, which we might translate as a simple equation. Insanity equals genius. He believed you can't have one without the other. In contrast, the statistician and founder of behavioral genetics, Francis Galton, took the opposing view, which we can summarize as sanity equals genius. Galton argued that intelligence, the strongest indicator of a healthy brain, produced genius. Both men saw genius as biological in origin, but one believed it arose from illness, the other from health. These two views have seeped into Western culture, with most of us reflexively preferring Galton over Lombroso. In this book, I take Lombroso's side with some qualifications. Throughout, I trace a basic law that emerges from studying the relation of mental illness to leadership. One might call it the inverse law of sanity. When times are good, when peace reigns and the ship of state only needs to sail straight, mentally healthy people function well as our leaders. When our world is in tumult, mentally ill leaders function best. Four key elements of some mental illnesses, mania and depression, appear to promote crisis leadership: realism, resilience, empathy, and creativity. These aren't just loosely defined character traits. They have specific psychiatric meanings and have been extensively studied scientifically. I use these terms in their scientific, not their common sense, meanings. Among these qualities, psychologists have studied creativity and empathy most, but resilience and realism are just as important for leadership and have also been examined in some detail by recent researchers. Of these four elements, all accompany depression, and two, creativity and resilience, can be found in manic illness. Except for resilience, none are specific for other mental illnesses like schizophrenia and anxiety disorders. Depression makes leaders more realistic and empathetic, and mania makes them more creative and resilient. Depression can occur by itself and can provide some of these benefits. When it occurs along with mania, bipolar disorder, even more leadership skills can ensue.
We have just listened to A First-Rate Madness by Nasser Gaimi. Here's a bit of digression, but from a much-loved author who gets into our heads with each of his titles. Richard Dawkins, perhaps the world's most famous evolutionary biologist, examined some of nature's most fundamental questions from a mythic and scientific perspective in The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Science is our most precise and powerful tool for making sense of the world. Before the development of the scientific method, rich mythologies were created to explain the unknown. The questions that primitive men asked are the same ones we ask as children. Who was the first person? What is the sun? Why is there night and day? Dawkins, who narrates with Lalla Ward, answers these big questions. Looking first at some of the myths that arose to answer the big questions, he then brings us the facts. He looks at the building blocks of matter, the first humans, the sun, the life and death of stars, why there's a night and a day, and poses the question that still baffles scientists. When did everything begin? Let's listen.
What about a distant galaxy too far away to be seen with the naked eye? What about a bacterium too small to be seen without a powerful microscope? Must we say that these do not exist because we can't see them? No. Obviously, we can enhance our senses through the use of special instruments, telescopes for the galaxy, microscopes for bacteria. Because we understand telescopes and microscopes and how they work, we can use them to extend the reach of our senses, in this case the sense of sight. And what they enable us to see convinces us that galaxies and bacteria exist. How about radio waves? Do they exist? Our eyes can't detect them, nor can our ears, but again, special instruments, television sets for example, convert them into signals that we can see and hear. So although we can't see or hear radio waves, we know they are a part of reality. As with telescopes and microscopes, we understand how radios and televisions work. So they enable our senses to build a picture of what exists, the real world, reality. Radio telescopes and X-ray telescopes show us stars and galaxies through what seem like different eyes, another way to expand our view of reality. Back to those dinosaurs. How do we know that they once roamed the Earth? We've never seen them or heard them or had to run away from them. Alas, we don't have a time machine to show them to us directly. But here we have a different kind of aid to our senses. We have fossils, and we can see them with the naked eye. Fossils don't run and jump, but because we understand how fossils are formed, they can tell us something of what happened millions of years ago. We understand how water, with minerals dissolved in it, seeps into corpses buried in layers of mud and rock. We understand how the minerals crystallize out of the water and replace the materials of the corpse, atom by atom, leaving some trace of the original animal's form imprinted on the stone. So, although we can't see dinosaurs directly with our senses, we can work out that they must have existed using indirect evidence that still ultimately reaches us through our senses. We see and touch the stony traces of ancient life. In a different sense, a telescope can work like a kind of time machine. What we see when we look at anything is actually light, and light takes time to travel. Even when you look at a friend's face, you're seeing them in the past, because the light from their face takes a tiny fraction of a second to travel to your eye. Sound travels much more slowly, which is why you see a firework burst in the sky noticeably earlier than you hear the bang. When you watch a man chopping down a tree in the distance, there's an odd delay in the sound of his axe hitting the tree.
Light travels so fast that we normally assume anything we see happens at the instant we see it. But stars are another matter. Even the sun is 8 light minutes away. If the sun blew up, this catastrophic event wouldn't become a part of our reality until 8 minutes later. And that would be the end of us. As for the next nearest star, Proxima Centauri, if you look at it in 2011, what you are seeing is happening in 2007. Galaxies are huge collections of stars. We are in one galaxy called the Milky Way. When you look at the Milky Way's next-door neighbour, the Andromeda Galaxy, your telescope is a time machine, taking you back 2.5 million years. There's a cluster of 5 galaxies called Stefan's Quintet, which we see through the Hubble telescope, spectacularly colliding with each other. But we see them colliding 280 million years ago. If there are aliens in one of those colliding galaxies, with a telescope powerful enough to see us, what they are seeing on Earth at this very moment, here and now, is the early ancestors of the dinosaurs. Are there really aliens in outer space? We've never seen or heard them. Are they a part of reality? Nobody knows. But we do know what kind of things could one day tell us if they are. If ever we got near to an alien, our sense organs could tell us about it. Perhaps somebody will one day invent a telescope powerful enough to detect life on other planets from here.
We've just heard a clip from The Magic of Reality by Richard Dawkins. We've all had the experience of reading about a shocking crime and asking, "What is the world coming to?" But we seldom ask, "Was the world this bad in the past?" In his new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, cognitive scientist Steven Pinker shows that the world of the past was much worse.
In fact, we may be living in the most peaceable era in our species' existence. Evidence of a bloody history has always been around us. The genocides in the Old Testament, the gory mutilations in Shakespeare, the British monarchs who beheaded their relatives. Now, with the help of more than 100 graphs and maps, Pinker presents some astonishing numbers. Tribal warfare was 9 times as deadly as war and genocide in the 20th century. The murder rate in medieval Europe was more than 30 times what it is today. Wars kill a fraction of the numbers they did a few decades ago. Rape, battering, hate crimes, deadly riots, child abuse, cruelty to animals, all substantially down. How could this have happened if human nature has not changed? What has led people to stop sacrificing children, stabbing each other at the dinner table? Pinker argues that the key to explaining the decline of violence is to understand the inner demons that incline us toward violence, revenge, sadism, and tribalism, and the better angels that steer us away. Thanks to the spread of government, literacy, trade, we increasingly control our impulses and empathize with others. We bargain rather than plunder. With intellectual zeal, Pinker will force you to rethink your deepest beliefs about progress. Arthur Morey narrates.
It may be. In absolute numbers, there will always be enough of them to fill the evening news. So people's impressions of violence will be disconnected from the actual proportions. Also distorting our sense of danger is our moral psychology. No one has ever recruited activists to a cause by announcing that things are getting better, and bearers of good news are often advised to keep their mouths shut lest they lull people into complacency. Also, a large swath of our intellectual culture is loath to admit that there could be anything good about civilization, modernity, and Western society. But perhaps the main cause of the illusion of ever-present violence springs from one of the forces that drove violence down in the first place. The decline of violent behavior has been paralleled by a decline in attitudes that tolerate or glorify violence, and often the attitudes are in the lead. By the standards of the mass atrocities of human history, the lethal injection of a murderer in Texas, or an occasional hate crime in which a member of an ethnic minority is intimidated by hooligans, is pretty mild stuff. But from a contemporary vantage point, we see them as signs of how low our behavior can sink, not of how high our standards have risen. In the teeth of these preconceptions, I will have to persuade you with numbers, which I will glean from data sets and depict in graphs. In each case, I'll explain where the numbers came from and do my best to interpret the ways they fall into place. The problem I've set out to understand is the reduction in violence at many scales, in the family, in the neighborhood, between tribes and other armed factions, and among major nations and states. If the history of violence at each level of granularity had an idiosyncratic trajectory, each would belong in a separate book. But to my repeated astonishment, the global trends in almost all of them, viewed from the vantage point of the present, point downward. That calls for documenting the various trends between a single pair of covers and seeking commonalities in when, how, and why they have occurred. Too many kinds of violence, I hope to convince you, have moved in the same direction for it all to be a coincidence. And that calls for an explanation. It is natural to recount the history of violence as a moral saga, a heroic struggle of justice against evil, but that is not my starting point. My approach is scientific in the broad sense of seeking explanations for why things happen. We may discover that a particular advance in peacefulness was brought about by moral entrepreneurs and their movements, but we may also discover that the explanation is more prosaic, like a change in technology, governance, commerce, or knowledge. Nor can we understand the decline of violence as an unstoppable force for progress that is carrying us toward an omega point of perfect peace. It is a collection of statistical trends in the behavior of groups of humans in various epochs, and as such it calls for an explanation in terms of psychology and history, how human minds deal with changing circumstances. A large part of the book will explore the psychology of violence and nonviolence, The theory of mind that I will invoke is the synthesis of cognitive science, affective and cognitive neuroscience, social and evolutionary psychology, and other sciences of human nature that I explored in How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, and The Stuff of Thought. According to this understanding, the mind is a complex system of cognitive and emotional faculties implemented in the brain, which owe their basic design to the processes of evolution. Some of these faculties incline us toward various kinds of violence. Others, the better angels of our nature, in Abraham Lincoln's words, incline us toward cooperation and peace. The way to explain the decline of violence is to identify the changes in our cultural and material milieu that have given our peaceable motives the upper hand. Finally, I need to show how our history has engaged our psychology.
That was The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker. On June 6, 1924, two men set out from a camp perched at 23,000 feet, just below the lip of Mount Everest North Col. George Mallory, 37, was Britain's finest climber. Sandy Irvine was a young Oxford scholar of 22, with little previous mountaineering experience. Neither of them returned. In an amazingly researched work of history and adventure, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest, Wade Davis vividly recreates British climbers' epic attempts to scale Mount Everest in the 1920s. With new access to letters and diaries, Davis analyzes the heroic efforts of George Mallory and his fellow climbers to conquer the mountain in the face of treacherous terrain and furious weather. And Into the Silence sets their remarkable achievements in sweeping historical context. Davis shows how the exploration originated in the 19th century imperial ambitions and rose from the trenches of World War I, where Mallory and his generation found their world utterly shattered. In the wake of the war that destroyed all notions of honor and decency, the Everest expedition, led by the scions of British elite, emerged as a symbol of national redemption and hope. N. Rytel narrates.
And further along, the second step, a 100-foot bluff that would have to be scaled. Though concerned about Irvine's lack of experience, Norton had done nothing to alter the composition of the team. Mallory was a man possessed. A veteran of all three British expeditions, he knew Everest better than anyone alive. 2 days later, on the morning of June 8, Mallory and Irvine set out from their high camp for the summit. The bright light of dawn gave way to soft shadows as luminous banks of clouds passed over the mountain. Noel O'Dell, a brilliant climber in support, last saw them alive at 12:50 p.m., faintly from a rocky crag, two small objects moving up the ridge. As the mist rolled in, enveloping their memory in myth, he was the only witness. Mallory and Irvine would not be seen or heard from again. Their disappearance would haunt a nation and give rise to the greatest mystery in the history of mountaineering. Never did O'Dell doubt that they reached the summit before meeting their end, nor did he question the sublime purpose that had led them all to cross hundreds of miles on foot from India and across Tibet just to reach the base of the mountain. O'Dell wrote of his two lost friends, "My final glimpse of one whose personality was of that charming character that endeared him to all and whose natural gifts seemed to indicate such possibilities of both mind and body was that he was going strong, sharing with that other fine character who accompanied him, such a vision of sublimity that it has been the lot of few mortals to behold. Few, while beholding, have become merged into such a scene of transcendence." Chapter 1. Great Gable. On the very day that George Mallory and Sandy Irvine disappeared on Everest, another party of British climbers slowly made their way to the summit of a quite different mountain, and in very different circumstances. At 2,949 feet, Great Gable was not a serious or difficult climb, but it was said to be the most completely beautiful of English mountains. It anchored the fells of Cumbria, and from its summit could be seen a dozen or more of the rounded hills and rocky crags of the Lake District, where so many English climbers had first discovered the freedom of open space and the feel of wind and rain and sleet on cold hands jammed into cracks of granite and slate. There were some 80 men and women in this solemn party, most of them members of the Fell and Rock Climbing Club, a loose association founded in 1906 and dedicated exclusively to the celebration of the English hills. Among them was the club secretary, Leslie Somerville, whose brother Howard was then with the Everest expedition, and Arthur Wakefield, club president since 1923. Wakefield had served as medical officer on the 1922 Everest expedition and had been the first to rush to the relief of the climbers swept away by the avalanche on the North Col that buried alive 7 Sherpa porters. Death was something he knew well. The most prominent figure on Great Gable this day was Geoffrey Winthrop Young, who brought up the rear, supported by his wife Len, as he struggled over boulders and whetstones in rain so fierce it swept the cape from his back. Considered by many to be the greatest English mountaineer of his era, Young was the mentor of Mallory and had been responsible for both Mallory and Wakefield securing invitations to join the Everest expeditions. This was his first climb since losing his left leg to an Austrian shell on the night of August 31, 1917, at Mont Saint-Gabriel while serving on the Isonzo front in Italy. In time, he would summit the Matterhorn with a prosthetic limb of his own design. But for the moment, it was all he could do to keep his balance and move steadily up the slope toward the others. A gifted Georgian poet and fine orator, he was here at Wakefield's invitation to help dedicate a bronze plaque inscribed with the names of those members of the FRCC who had been lost in the war, and to consecrate in their memory a tract of some 3,000 acres purchased by the survivors and gifted by them to the nation as a living memorial.
That was Into the Silence by Wade Davis. Fraser, author of Cold Mountain and 13 Moons, returns with Nightwoods, a novel of suspense set in small-town North Carolina in the early 1960s. Yes, Fraser can really turn a phrase, though I do take umbrage with his line describing my hometown, quote, South Florida is the drain of the country's bathtub. Uh-huh. But in this title, Fraser creates a memorable heroine with his portrait of Luce, a young woman who inherits her murdered sister's troubled twins. Before the children, Luce was content with her solitude for sad reasons that unfurl slowly in the book. Now, Luce must act to protect the children from her sister's killer, a man who has hurt the children terribly and stalks them now. Readers, this book did not have the historical sweep of Cold Mountain, and I found Will Patton's narration too slow and too plodding, but you be the judge. Let's listen.
Lodge had been a cool summer retreat for rich people escaping the lowland steam of August. Some railroad millionaire passing through the Highland Valley in his own rail car had a vision, or possibly a whim, to build an earthen dam, back the river up, fill the upper end of the valley with water right to the edge of the village. Then, on the far side, build a log lodge of his own design, something along the lines of the Old Faithful Inn, though smaller and more exclusive. He must have been a better railroad executive than architect, because what he built was a raw, outsized rectangle, a huge log cabin with a covered porch looking down a sweep of lawn to the lake and across the water to the town. Evidently, rich people were satisfied by simpler things in the yesteryears. Now, the millionaires and the railroad were gone, but the lake remained. A weird, color-shifting horizontal plain set in an otherwise convoluted vertical landscape of blue and green mountains. The lodge persisted as well, a strange, decaying place to live in alone, though. The main floor was taken up by the common rooms, a voluminous lobby with its massive stone fireplace and handsome, back-breaking craftsman armchairs and settles, quarter sawn oak tables and cabinets. A long dining room with triple-hung lake-view windows, and behind swinging doors, a big kitchen with a small table where the help once crowded together to eat leftovers. Second floor, just narrow hallways and sleeping chambers behind numbered 6-panel doors with transom windows. Third floor, way up under the eaves, a dark, smothering rabbit warren of windowless servants' quarters. When she lived alone, Luce didn't go to the upper floors often, but not out of fear. Not really. It was little but bedsteads and cobwebs up there, and she didn't want to believe in ghosts or anything similar. Not even the portents of bad dreams. Yet the fading spirit world touched her imagination pretty strong when she was awake at 3 a.m. alone in the big place. The dark sleeping floors with their musty transient pens and cribs for the guests and their help spooked her. The place spoke of time, how you're here and then you're gone, and all you leave for a little while afterward are a few artifacts that outlive you. Case in point, old Stubblefield, who had owned the lodge for the past few decades. Luce visited him several times during his dying days, and she was there at the end to watch the light go out of his eyes. In the final hours, Stubblefield mostly catalogued his possessions and listed who should get what. His concerns were largely real estate, all his holdings to go to his sole, useless grandson. Also, a few valuable objects, such as his dead wife's silver service and lace tablecloth, perfect but for a slight rust stain at one corner, barely noticeable. The silver candle holders were a heavy weight on Stubblefield's mind, because his wife had loved them so much. Oddly, he left them to Luce, who didn't love them at all, and probably never would. Easy to be disdainful and ironic toward others' false values. Still, Luce hoped that when she was at the same thin margin of life, she would be concerned with looking out the window to note the weather, or the shape of the moon, or some lone bird flying by. Certainly not a bunch of worn-out teaspoons. But Luce was half a century younger than old Stubblefield and didn't know how she'd think and what she would value if she made it that far down the road. All her life, the main lesson Luce had learned was that you couldn't count on anybody. So she guessed you could work hard to make yourself who you wanted to be and yet find that the passing years had transformed you beyond your own recognition. End up disappointed in yourself, despite your best efforts. And that's the downward way Luce's thoughts fell whenever she went upstairs into the dreary past. Before the children, Luce had learned that after dark she'd best keep to the communal lobby with its fireplace and mildew-spotted furniture and tall, full bookshelves and huge floor-standing radio with a tuning ring like the steering wheel to a Packard. She dragged a daybed from a screened sleeping porch to form a triangle of cozy space with the hearth and the radio to make herself a bedroom.
That was Nightwoods by Charles Fraser. Maphead by Ken Jennings. Yes, the Jeopardy legend with the 2004 streak that made him a folk hero and a king of trivia. Here he explores his love affair with geography in Maphead, charting the wide, weird world of geography wonks. This entertaining book explores why maps are fascinating and takes listeners on a world tour of geogeeks, from the London Map Fair to the bowels of the Library of Congress, from the geniuses at the National Geographic Bee to the computer programmers at Google Earth. Each chapter delves into a different aspect of map culture, high-pointing, geocaching, road atlas rallying, even the unreal estate charted on the maps of fiction and fantasy. Jennings also considers the ways in which cartography has shaped our history. Maphead is filled with intriguing details, engaging anecdotes, and enlightening analysis. If you're a map lover or among the cartographically clueless, you'll find this an entertaining guide to a great obsession. Kirby Hayborn narrates.
On Lake Taal in the Philippines. But point your internet map of choice at 69.793 degrees north, 108.241 degrees west, the unnamed Canadian island in a lake on an island in a lake on Victoria Island is much bigger. But my childhood love of maps, I started to remember as I paged through the atlas, was something much more than this casual weirdness. I was consumed. Back then, I could literally look at maps for hours. I was a fast and voracious reader, and keenly aware that a page of hot Roald Dahl or Encyclopedia Brown action would last me only 30 seconds or so. But each page of an atlas was an almost inexhaustible trove of names and shapes and places, and I relished that sense of depth, of comprehensiveness. Travelers will return to a favorite place many times and order the same dish at the same cafe and watch the sun set from the same vantage point. I could do the same thing as a frequent armchair traveler, enjoying the familiarity of sights I had noticed before while always being surprised by new details. Look how Ardmore, Alabama, is only 100 feet away from its neighbor Ardmore, Louisiana, but there are 4,303 miles between St. George, Alaska, and St. George, South Carolina. Look at the lace-like coastline of the Musandam Peninsula, the northernmost point of the Arabian nation of Oman, an intricate fractal snowflake stretching into the Strait of Hormuz. Children love searching for tiny new details in a sea of complexity. It's the same principle that sold a bajillion Where's Waldo books. Mapmakers must know this, that detail, to many map lovers, is not just a means, but an end. The office globe next to my desk right now is pretty compact, but it makes room for all kinds of backwater hamlets in the western United States. Cole, Kansas. Alpine, Texas. Burns, Oregon. Mott, North Dakota. Population 808, about the same as a city block or two of Manhattan's Upper East Side. Even Ajo, Arizona makes the cut, and it's not even incorporated as a town. It's officially a CDP, or census-designated place. What do all these spots have in common, besides the fact that no one has ever visited them without first running out of gas? First, they all have nice short names. Second, they're each the only thing for miles around. So they neatly fill up an empty spot on the globe, and therefore make the product look denser with information. But I also remember a competing instinct in my young mind, a love for the way maps could suggest adventure by hinting at the unexplored. Joseph Conrad wrote about this urge at the beginning of Heart of Darkness. Now, when I was a little chap, I had a passion for maps. I would look for hours at South America or Africa or Australia and lose myself in all the glories of exploration. At that time, there were many blank spaces on the earth, and when I saw one that looked particularly inviting on a map, but they all looked that, I would put my finger on it and say, "When I grow up, I will go there." When I was a little chap, there were and are still a few mostly blank spaces on the map. Siberia, Antarctica, the Australian outback. But I knew these lacunae weren't just empty because they were rugged and remote. They were empty because nobody really wanted to live there. These were the places on the earth that, well, sort of sucked. So I never put my finger on the glaciers of Greenland and said, "I will go there," like Conrad's Marlowe. But I liked that they existed.
We've just heard a snippet of Maphead by Ken Jennings. Readers, I welcome your comments and suggestions about the show. In fact, one listener suggested I repeat the book title at the end of each audio sample, and I've done it. What a great idea. Please send me your thoughts by visiting my website, bookreportradio.com, and going to the Reader's Corner page. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.